Take a network break. Grab a virtual donut and join us for our weekly tech news analysis. We've got a couple of FUs, that's follow-ups, plus stories on Microsoft, VMware, Cisco, and more. One of our sponsors today is ExtraHop, the enterprise cyber analytics company delivering performance and security from the inside out. They offer complete visibility with machine learning to help you make quick, confident decisions about your IT environment. Explore the ExtraHop performance platform at extrahop.com/packetpushers. We're also sponsored by Telegeography, a telecommunications market research firm. They want you to know about their WAN cost benchmark. This is a tool that lets you model your hybrid WAN expansion plans and compare costs based on over 2 million data points. Head to benchmark.telegeography.com to learn more. And stay tuned after the news for a sponsored TechBytes conversation with SnapRoute, makers of CNNOS, or the Cloud Native Network Operating System. We're going to talk about how this OS is built from the ground up to work with your automation tools, why it runs Kubernetes at its core, and more.
Yeah, good discussion that, by the way. So interesting way of building a NOS using Kubernetes and containers and some interesting things. So it's worth tuning in, certainly for the first half, if you just want to get at different ideas on how to build a NOS and the way that they've gone about building their CNNOS cloud native operating system. It is actually unusual and food for thinking about, I think.
Heading toward the white box, the disaggregation space, you've got a lot of choices as an opportunity to learn a little bit more about one of those. All right, last but not least, on Tuesday, May 14th, we're doing a live event in New York City with Glueware. If you're interested in coming, we'd love to see you there, and you can find out more at packetpushers.net/glueware.
And that would be tomorrow.
If you're listening to this on Monday, yes, that would be tomorrow. So
yeah. You've got to pull your finger out and get there Tuesday afternoon. But if not, it's going to be a good event, live events. We didn't get quite as many people to sign up as we might have hoped for, but we would like to know if you think live events are worth doing. And if you think so, maybe you want to give us some feedback on places we should go for live events in the future. If you're in our Slack channel, pipe up. But if not, just email us on the usual addresses, packetpushers@gmail.com.
All right, let's get to our FUs. A Dell person got in touch with us to highlight that the smaller switches we discussed last week are particularly useful for storage networks.
Yeah, so we talked about the 12-port, 25-gig thing switches that Dell was sort of blathering about at their latest conference. They do the usual conference constipation where they save up all their announcements and splat them out in a single blurt, and it's very difficult to pick out signal from the noise in all of that. But his email just said he's finding them very useful for storage offerings, the storage where you buy a bunch of servers and then run software storage over the top. You don't need a 48-port switch to run that because usually you only need a half a dozen servers to drop, a half a petabyte of storage to get that. He's finding them very useful for that. And that way you can build a separate storage network from the main network so you don't have to worry about cross and all that. And also with VxRail solutions in the HCI space, which is what the point I think I was trying to make, because the VxRail bundles are usually sold with networking, and if the smaller switches are there, it reduces the cost of the HCI. So I think Dell's got quite a good idea here. Cisco, of course, wants to sell 48-port switches because the networking people buy them, so they can afford to throw 48 ports at people. And then, of course, Cisco also relies on selling you the SFP modules, which are very expensive in Cisco's world, so they make it up in licensing fees. So effectively, the high prices on the SFP becomes a per-port usage fee, in my mind. That's how I think of it anyway. So Dell's sort of giving themselves a differentiator, and I think on the ground, this will result in a much cheaper solution. So good feedback. I really like that. We also got some feedback. I made a commentary about last week about what silicon was in the switches that Dell talked about.
This is their new open networking switch.
Yeah. And everybody sort of pointed out that it's a Trident 3. So the ASICs inside the Dell S52XXON, which ON stands for open networking, the entire 52XX line is Trident 3. And in fact, quite a few people sent me some follow-up on that. Some people tweeted at me and sent me a DM or sent me a public message, and other people emailed. So thanks to everybody who said that, but we'll keep all of their contributions anonymous because I wasn't able to get to ask them if we should share their name. So we'll assume that anonymous is the right way to go.
And another follow-up, we had talked about an SD-WAN appliance and also some Cisco switches, and we got follow-up there too.
Yeah, so Brian sent me an email. He said he's pretty sure that the Dell SD-WAN appliance, which we hinted at last week, so that people could bring their SD-WAN software and put it on a Dell appliance, he's highlighting that's the VEP4600, and there's a link below that points to it. And in fact, so thanks for sending me that, Brian. And it was actually the thing that I was looking at in my browser. I just wasn't confident enough to put a link. I do try very hard to make sure that what we put into the show is correct and listed. So it's called the Dell EMC Networking Virtual Edge Platform, so VEP. So that looks very much like an x86 box with a half a dozen, with eight Ethernet ports, which is perfect for the SD-WAN sort of model.
And it's bundling VeloCloud, right?
Yeah. And then I also made some commentary about why Cisco would continue to include 40 gig capable ports. And he said they don't want to bone folks who believed in them 2 years ago and already have some in the rack. So a good point. You know, if you've got customers who bought 40 gig thinking it was the way of the future, even though it was obvious 2 years ago that was not the fact, Cisco wants to continue to give them backward compatibility. So you can see that either way you want. I see 40 gig as a distinctly legacy technology as much as 1 gig is, and you should try and kill it off with fire as quickly as possible. But he makes a good point. If you're in that mode, you probably want to get more 40 gig, and so Cisco's making that option available to you. No doubt at a substantial price, because 40 gig is expensive in every which way you look at it.
One last follow-up, a few from Juniper. We had a couple of weeks ago talked about their Contrail SD-WAN cloud-based solution, and we got a few things that we need to correct.
All right, big things. Made big boo-boos here. So I think we said at the time that the press release, we couldn't decode the press release to tell us what we needed to know. And I did quite a few hours of searching and really wasn't able to find anything searching around Juniper's website on the term SD-WAN. In the meantime, we've done a podcast with Juniper, a sponsored podcast, which is going to come out in a couple of weeks. So stand by for that. I really recommend listening to it because it really opened my eyes to what Juniper has. Now, the key here is to understand that Juniper's Contrail Service Orchestration, or CSO, is Juniper's SD-WAN solution. So if you're searching for it, you don't want to be searching on SD-WAN so much. You actually want to be searching for CSO or Contrail Service Orchestration. Now, I think the strategy here is, and I wasn't able to get all the questions resolved here, but my take on this is that CSO is more of an orchestration engine. It can do more than just SD-WAN, if that makes sense, Drew. So it does SD-WAN as much as it does a whole bunch of other things. So you can use it to do SD-WAN, and there's a whole deployment guide that I was sent on how to do SD-WAN, and it's part of what we talk about in the sponsor podcast with Juniper. And this leads to a couple of bits of hardware. They've got the SD-WAN Edge devices are products in the SRX and the NFX families of products. So the SRX firewalls support a range of what I would consider normal SD-WAN features like application recognition, dynamic path selection, automatic path selection by on a per-flow basis, all the sorts of things that you would expect from an SD-WAN solution pretty much built into the SRX operating system, which makes sense. SRX is an application layer firewall these days, so it can do the application recognition. And then it's just a case of Juniper adding some BGP as a message bus to pass path selection and configuration information around, and away they go. So that's what they've done. The NFX is a more traditional, well, I guess, SD-WAN appliance. That is, most vendors are using an x86 type of an appliance with four or eight Ethernet ports in it. And it's got an NFV capability so that you can then bring along your favorite VMs, like your favorite legacy firewall or print server or data loss prevention solution, whatever it is. So you can take the NFX and put it. And I've also got virtual software versions of this as well, so you can put it on other people's NFV solutions if that's what you want. So the basic conclusion here is the mistake I made was I thought that the original version was that they were configuring routers to do active standby. So they were doing just basic configuration of the routing to get this SD-WAN. That's not true. They've got a fully competitive SD-WAN solution here with its own strengths and weaknesses. And get into the podcast that we recorded to get a much deeper dive than I can cover here in a few minutes. So I particularly think that, aficionados of BGP, a 40-year-old routing protocol, you'll be in CLI heaven while actually getting SDN in the front door. So I think it's a good way of getting people who have sort of got Juniper very heavy on the BGP and the routing stuff. I think Juniper's got a very strong story here. The rest of the SD-WAN is perfectly competent, and, it's got its strengths and its weaknesses. And I just wonder, if I can't find SD-WAN on Juniper's website with a couple of hours of searching, I just wonder how many other engineers would be out there would understand the idea that Contrail Service Orchestration is actually an SD-WAN product. And if you're out shopping for an SD-WAN solution without sales reps doorstepping you to tell you that, how would you know?
It does. That seems like a bit of a little tweak maybe they want to consider on the marketing side to help folks find out that this product is available and exists.
Yeah, you know, if you want an SD-WAN solution, you don't go searching for service orchestration platform. You search for Juniper SD-WAN, and that should point at something. And unfortunately, I wasn't getting those answers from Juniper's website. And so I apologize to the audience for not getting that right, and I apologize to Juniper, and hopefully this rectifies it. And fortunately, we've also got a podcast, which I spent many hours preparing for to change my opinion. So apologies all around. Hopefully we'll get it right next time.
That's right, and that's what the FU section is for. We want to make sure that we're delivering good information, correct information. So if you hear something that you disagree with or think we got wrong, absolutely follow up with us. Let us know. We'll take a look at it, and if we think it deserves a follow-up, then we certainly will.
Yeah, and your opinions matter too. So it doesn't just have to be, oh, you got this wrong. You know, as we saw up here, somebody gave us an opinion about this product fitting into this space that we didn't cover. I'd be more than happy to take your opinions and perspectives into account. And as long as we agree and think they're relevant and you know, are worth talking about, we'll definitely do them. We love to hear from you. So I'm actually really pleased that all these people are sending us this follow-up. It's just fantastic.
And if you want to leave an FU, you can comment on the show notes on the blog post, packetpushers.net, that accompanies the podcast, or drop us an email, packetpushers@gmail.com. And we may even decide to put together a website, a URL just for follow-ups. We'll bring you back more on that.
I think it'd be cool to have a webpage, packetpushers.net/FU. that just seems
tickles,
like a
tickles
a little cheeky, a little tickles my sense of humor. If you say.
All right, well, let's get into some news analysis. Microsoft has announced that it will include a Linux kernel in Windows. It's part of a forthcoming release of the second version of the Windows Subsystem for Linux, or WSL. This is going to be a full Linux kernel running in a VM on Windows.
Yeah, aside from the fact that hell might have just frozen over, or you know, that some people are rolling in their graves, you know, all that sort of stuff. I think Microsoft has sort of recognized that one of the weaknesses in its strategy is that people use Linux everywhere, and to make Linux go well, you need a good SSH client, which they fixed a couple of years back, finally. But increasingly, people want to be able to run Docker on Windows, and they don't want to have to go through these emulation layers. They want a straight up. So what Microsoft's saying is they're actually going to pull 4.19 of the kernel directly from kernel.org, compile it, and then it will be in Windows, so that when you want to call Linux functions, you'll actually be hitting a straight up Linux kernel. So that should be much easier for everybody involved, I suspect.
Right, streamlining the system calls, yes.
Yeah. So analyzing that, I think, Microsoft is thumping on the openness thing, you know, the GitHub, the cloud, we're supporting open source projects, all that sort of stuff. You know, we're here for the developers. So this is very much a developer move, so that developers don't have to go to Macs to have some decent Linux or some decent Docker support, which is as many of them as going. And I think it's also about revenue protection. So a lot of big companies are sort of not happy that you have to use a Mac to get a decent Linux administration or developer laptop. And this starts to shift that back towards Microsoft, because you've got less excuses to not use Windows, if that makes sense.
That's interesting. I didn't think about that point. And if you're an enterprise, and it's easier to manage one fleet than two fleets. So if you can get everybody on Windows and keep your developers happy by having that Linux integration, then yeah.
Yeah. And you keep your monopoly intact. The further you know.
Sure. That's definitely in Microsoft's interest.
Yeah. You don't want people wandering too far from the home pastures, because they might find that it's actually greener on the other side of the hill.
Yeah.
So this is very much a, you know, reflection of current Microsoft. All right, we'll give customers what they want. They want Linux on the laptop. That's fine. Let's give them that. And there's lots of good reasons to do that. The bloviation in the blog post, you know, like, which is a true testament to how much Microsoft loves Linux. I'm like, that's a bit of a stretch, but okay. Keep flexing. but I do think it's good overall. For a lot of people, Windows is okay. You give me a Linux kernel so I can run my Docker containers and use my development tools like VS Code and so forth, then this is a good step forward. So it's a good, and good blog post aside from the bloviation piece, just skip over that on Microsoft's website in the show notes.
That's right. And this isn't the first time that Microsoft has gone open source or borrowed from others to advance its own products. Their Edge browser, they're using Google's open source Chromium engine. So I think we have seen a different Microsoft under the Satya Nadella regime, certainly slightly more open and definitely more willing to say, this is a direction we got to go. It doesn't have to be all in-house what we're doing.
Yeah, that's right. Bending with the times, I think.
Yeah, bend, don't break, I guess.
Yeah, that's
the new
right.
approach. All right, moving on. In the flurry of releases from Dell EMC World that we talked about last week, we did miss one interesting announcement. This is VMware Cloud on Dell EMC. It combines VMware software and Dell hardware that sits on your premises but is managed by VMware.
Yeah, I sort of missed this last week. I just saw the VMware vCloud cloud managed, and it was just a bunch of adjectives that just didn't make any sense, to be fair. Another one of these, you know, constipation type announcements, and you lose sight of it. This is really interesting in the sense that what you're effectively doing is renting on-prem hardware. So that's the fundamental premise.
Yep.
You're renting Dell EMC's hardware. They come along and put the hardware in your data center. You don't buy it, and you pay as you consume it. And this includes VMware's software-defined data center. So you'll actually, Dell EMC will roll in a rack. It'll probably look a lot like a V-block, to be fair.
VxRail.
It is a VxRail, but it looks like, you know. Now, the interesting thing here is that the control plane is managed from the cloud. So externally, all of your software-defined data center or your vCloud management functions are hosted remotely, and then it's all deployed locally, and then you rent it. So a couple of weeks ago, we talked about Nutanix coming on board with HP's GreenLake, similar sort of model here. So clearly there's demand for this amongst customers. You can bet that if the two major vendors are producing, you know, on-prem buy-as-you-go type products, that there's demand for it with the customers because one's following the other, you would imagine.
That's right. Yeah. And just to be clear, Dell slash VMware will do the installation on your site. They are then responsible for patches and upgrades of the software. They're going to monitor the hardware. They'll do repairs or ship replacements as necessary. And again, it's VxRail, half or full rack with VxRail servers, top of rack switches, and NSX SD-WAN by VeloCloud for your connectivity. So yeah, and again, you mentioned GreenLake. Yeah, we're seeing the big folks get into this cloud model of purchasing and spreading out that cost. Pay for what you use. It makes a lot of sense.
I think so. So this is for customers who really want to go into the cloud. I see that, again, this is revenue protection. If you give them an option to stay on-prem and rent it, you can claim that you're going to the cloud and you can kind of...
Well, yeah, and they'll also make a very big deal about the hybrid story in that, okay, now you've got a similar operating model on-premises and in whatever public cloud you're using, and with VMware now available on AWS and Azure, lots of public clouds to choose from. So yeah, they can also tell that hybrid cloud story.
Yeah, and I think that in that sense, and there's a lot of demand from customers to do OpEx. They don't want CapEx. Mm-hmm. So... here you go. I think you would have to be very large to make this work. Like, we're not talking about $10,000 a month here. I think you're talking like $1 million a year to make it worthwhile to pre-ship you hardware, because they have to take all that cost on the chin.
They do.
And all the unless you negotiate a particular deal, and then you have to go through it. So it'd be interesting to know the details.
Yeah, if anyone has insights on the sizing or the deal sort of minimum that you have to buy into on this, we'd love to hear that. I didn't see any about that in the context that I read about for this.
That all the VMware salary slaves are running around yelling, game changer, world changing. And I was like, it's not a game. It's just an obvious thing that you had to do. Calm down, son. Relax. It's perfectly obvious. You're just keeping up with the competition, right? Don't worry about it. Yeah.
Yes.
Calm down.
All right, a quick break for a sponsor message from ExtraHop. They are the enterprise cyber analytics company delivering performance and security from the inside out. IT and network operations teams are responsible for managing the applications and infrastructure that modern enterprises depend on, but SDN, cloud, and shadow IT create blind spots, especially when it comes to applications that can't be instrumented. ExtraHop is helping teams like yours rise above the noise of tool sprawl and complexity with complete visibility and machine learning to help you make quick, confident decisions about your IT environment. You can explore the ExtraHop performance platform at extrahop.com/packetpushers. And if you want a deeper dive into ExtraHop's ML capabilities, we did an episode with them on Priority Queue 128, which gets into details about how they're using machine learning to parse packet and flow data to get actionable intelligence. So thanks, ExtraHop, for being a sponsor. All right, back to the news. Cisco has announced Cisco SD-WAN Cloud On-Ramp for co-location. And let's take a second to unpack all that. This is a hardware and software combination aimed at organizations that, for whatever reason, don't want their branch offices to connect directly to the internet or cloud services. And instead of backhauling all that branch traffic to corporate headquarters, these companies can now send traffic to a local colo site.
Odd sort of an announcement. This I can't quite be certain if this is like a standard feature in other vendors' SD-WAN products or if this is something that Cisco's gotten to faster than others. So it's a little difficult to decode it, perhaps, from the announcements that you've got. But my understanding is that, let's say you've got a UK head office organization and the head office is here, but you've got a bunch of branches in the US. Mm-hmm. What you don't want to do is bring all the internet traffic back to the UK and then have it scanned in the head office. You want to do the breakout in the region where you're at. So put one of these Cisco devices, hardware devices, into a colo facility, and then you can start to set up these partial mesh networks in regions so that you can do local breakout. This would be definitely relevant if you have some sort of internal policy around wanting to scan all the traffic that goes out,
yep.
But you don't want to change your infrastructure to use a cloud-managed service like Cisco's Umbrella or Zscaler or one of those online security managed services. Maybe you've got mm-hmm. some sort of existing inside tool. And this looks to me, and I'm not sure I'm right here, so you need to do your own things. This looks like a licensing feature of, you know, a particular product. And I just wonder if Cisco's being a little greedy here to nickel and dime people into buying features that should just be part of the product, that I think.
To me, it's the way they're positioning, and it's, I'd almost reverse your example, where if I'm an American company and I've got a bunch of branch offices in the UK and Europe where I'm under, say, GDPR regulations, and I don't want to have to back all that ball back to the US to meet compliance requirements, I can keep it locally in a colo site, have a semi-centralized, you know, policy and control feature capabilities, and do it that way. So the basic idea is that you can set up connectivity to the colo, you can use SD-WAN, you can use VPNs, and then this cloud services platform is a big server. You can, it supports NFV, so you can run a bunch of software and policy enforcement tools on it. It's an odd duck. I think it's Cisco saying, look at how we're innovating for our customers and helping them solve their problems. Be curious to see if other SD-WAN providers go this way.
Yeah, Cisco is one of those companies that'll do things that customers ask for, even if it's a dumb thing. That's either a good thing or a bad thing, depending on your perspective, because sometimes people ask for things that they shouldn't. Then they don't know, they're not smart enough or aware enough to know that they're asking for something wrong. I think the interesting thing here is that they specifically call out in the documentation that you set these up in colos. So they're not saying, so for example, if you're in Australia and you've got an office in Sydney, Melbourne, and Brisbane, you would put this in a colo. You wouldn't put it in the head office. And that's because that's where the bandwidth is, the internet access and so forth. And so there's a, that's, it does sound a bit like a unique thing. Maybe, again, I'm not getting the full nuance behind this. And again, I wasn't able to spend quite a bit of time poking at the press release and reading in on the documentation to try and understand this. So if someone's got some more feedback, some more FAQ on that, then that would be great.
Yep. And we've got links to the information that Cisco has made available if you want to check it out for yourself.
Yep.
The New York Times recently reported that Chinese hackers repurposed NSA exploits and then reused them. The article speculates that the exploits were used against the Chinese first, and then they essentially grabbed the code and turned it around on other targets.
Yeah, so this is really interesting in the sense that in the background of the geopolitical stuff that's going on between the US and China, somebody in the USA decided to, in the US military, the NSA in this case, used a hacking tool somewhere. The Chinese saw it and then worked out what it was or captured the attack and then started to use it back against the NSA. So, I mean, I think there's a couple of interesting things here is that semantic, the New York Times article talks about it as if it came from the shadow brokers, but then Symantec released a blog post saying that the Chinese had the attack a year before shadow brokers released it onto the internet.
Right.
So this is very messy. So did the Chinese actually work it out themselves? Were they attacked by the NSA or did they capture it from somewhere else? It's not, and the press articles here are, the US press has been caught short here again, making claims that they're not entirely able to attribute accurately. Like we've seen this plenty of times, like Bloomberg technology is basically untrustable at this point in time for its layout, just because it just tries to make everything into a massive beta. You know, like the backdoors in Huawei and the Supermicro hardware backdoors, and everything's like the Chinese are coming to get it. I'm not sure that this is the case here. I think this is someone used a cyber weapon and the military maybe didn't cop on to the fact that if you use it, you're actually giving it away to anybody that's out there. Or maybe they did it and took a risk and said, you know, that's just what we have to do to get this done. So it's very interesting in that sense that I do wonder how military doctrine is going to calculate that once we use a weapon, the enemy can then use it against us and whether they're ready for that.
Yeah, so in my reading of it, it didn't sound like the Chinese used it against the United States. They did target other Western countries, though, partly because, A, they may not have wanted to let the U.S. know that they had it, and B, because they may have presumed that because the U.S. knew about these exploits, they had already, you know, patched them themselves. But absolutely, you're right. I think we saw this back with the, was it Stuxnet that we used to attack Iranian control systems on nuclear reactors that then had knock-on effects that we weren't anticipating?
I think the thing that's interesting here is like the New York Times says Chinese spies got the NSA's hacking tools, right? And ThreatPost says Chinese spies stole NSA cyber weapons. And then the Register basically says they just got leaked online. and there's definitely this thing in the US press where if the Chinese are involved, it was stolen or got them and abused them, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And it's, and the reality is often just very different in that, you know, once you see an attack, you can take it and use it yourself, right?
I mean, I guess if you shot someone and then they kept the bullet and managed to fire it back at you, you couldn't really say they stole the bullet.
Security coverage is really in a hole at the moment. They tend to use, you know, abusive words like stole and active and, you know, hostile words that get clickbaity. And they lose credibility when they do it, I think. So,
yeah, so if you want more detail, we've got a link to the Symantec post, which I think does a pretty good job of outlining the whole situation a little bit more carefully.
Yeah, and there's three articles there. You can read the different takes on the stories and make your own decision about what you want to write up. Yeah,
I always love the Register. There's been a rash of recent stories that call into question the security capabilities of IT vendors. The most recent is IT service provider Wipro admitted a security breach. Now reporting shows the attackers may have had access to their systems for more than a year. There are also reports about hackers penetrating three U.S. antivirus companies and selling source code or offering source code or access. And then recently we talked about Citrix also having its own systems breached.
I think the message is becoming clear here if that, you know, Wipro, Citrix, and other people have actually got hackers inside their networks roaming around at will, sometimes for months or year at a time. Vendors are now a weakness in the supply chain, and you're going to have to start thinking about, are my vendors actually secure? Now, the reason that I mention this is because in this case, the article that was published over on ThreatPost and Bleeping Computer, the original article was published on Bleeping Computer and then summarized by ThreatPost.com, they're making the point that this hacker disappeared off the internet for 6 months and then suddenly reappears 6 months later selling access to three antivirus vendors' networks, and he has all of the source code for all of their tools. And he's now they haven't actually been able to get them and verify that particular piece, but they make the case that make reasonable attribution or credible attribution that makes stands up to some sort of logical approach. So if antivirus vendors are being breached, Citrix got breached for 5 months or more and then threw salt on the wound by appointing Equifax to help you out. Equifax of all people, right?
Why would you do that?
And then we've got the Wipro with apparently the attackers have been inside the Wipro network for years. Now, Wipro is particularly important because Wipro is the outsourcer's outsourcer. That is,
right. Quite
often they're doing the outsourcing for companies like IBM. So IBM might take the contract and then flip it to Wipro to operate, or any, you know, Accenture or any of the others. They quite often don't run the contracts long term. They just sub them straight out. So you may not even know that your outsourcing contract is at Wipro, but people are definitely inside of Wipro networks. And my experience when I did an audit of them many years ago was that the Wipro internal security wasn't up to any sort of modern standard. So I think we're going to see a lot more of this, you know, hackers are inside of the supply chain and getting access to stuff. Now, keep in mind that that doesn't mean that they're targeting you particularly, but we need to start thinking about how are vendors actually taking steps to secure their network, and are they maintaining the integrity of their networks and their products or their services?
Right. So not only are you responsible for your own infrastructure and systems, you've got to be very careful about third-party providers and folks you're working with.
Yes. That's definitely what I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and we've seen plenty of reason to assume that our vendors have been pretty lazy around internal security.
Yeah, good luck. speaking of which, I'm not sure if this is just a coincidence or if Microsoft folks are really clever, but Microsoft recently released a post with Security Device where they detail some of their own internal practices. There's a blog that explains how the company requires IT administrators inside Microsoft to use separate computers for administrative tasks and to have a separately issued identity that's only for admin tasks and has no access to the internet.
Which is interesting in the sense that most people were issued with one laptop and they use that for administration and for internal use. And Microsoft is suggesting that if you're going to administer infrastructure or services, you would have one laptop or, you know, one computer for internal use and another one for administrative use, and the two should be entirely separate. And the one that you use for administration shouldn't be used for day-to-day. The obvious snark here is that, you know, double the computers for zero effort, you know, double the licenses. But this is actually fairly reasonable, although most people would have an RDP box somewhere where they actually create a thin screen to a jump server, which is in the middle, and then administration of infrastructure is usually done via an intermediate box. Uh-huh. But for developers, that's not necessarily the case. Developers often have need the bigger desktop or local compute capability. And I think that's what it's trying to drive at, is you need a special laptop. And because Active Directory is pretty messy and it's not actually all that secure, the purpose of Active Directory wasn't to actually be secure or safe back in the days when it first came out. Active Directory was just a way to prevent competitors from taking over their platform. It locked everybody out by locking up the identity. And that was its purpose. It wasn't actually to improve security. So, you know, the people who've got rights to get administrator access to the Active Directory have actually got rights to everything. So this is one way to you know, say, yes, you've got rights to do the Active Directory, but you've got no rights to other things and control that access. So I'm not a Windows expert here, so read the blog posts and get standard. I think this is an attempt by Microsoft to start suggesting to people that you need to get smarter about your supply chain and your admins in particular.
Well, it also focuses very much on identity, on provisioning, on multi-factor authentication, on role-based access. I mean, these are all common security practices, but they do sort of give you a little bit more insight into how they're doing it. And also, I tip my hat to them for also noting in the blog that this caused some friction with how people did their work, and so we had to make some adjustments. You know, there's always a balance between introducing security and friction, and people will find workarounds. So I appreciate the fact that they mentioned you can't just steamroll everyone and say, this is how we're doing it now.
Yeah, it's quite a comprehensive blog post that sort of explains how things should look and a way of operating. So it's worth thinking about it. And then because it comes from Microsoft, of course, CIOs can't ignore it, or the people that you manage just can't say, no, I'm not listening. I've got other things to do.
That's right.
You know, they have to listen to this when Microsoft says this is the way things work.
Yeah, so check it out. All right, another quick break to tell you about our other sponsor, Telegeography, telecommunications market research firm. You might know them from their work on the WAN Summit. Today, we want to tell you about the WAN cost benchmark from Telegeography. This is a tool that allows you to model your hybrid WAN expansion plans. Specifically, it helps you stay on top of the projected cost of your new sites. With the WAN cost benchmark, you can build unlimited network scenarios, compare network costs between different scenarios, export network scenario data, and get alerts when the underlying cost of your network changes. The big idea is that this tool helps users find the network plan that delivers the best balance of capacity and cost, and the WAN cost benchmark is backed by Telegeography's pricing database. That's over 2 million data points for benchmarking your network. Head on over to benchmark.telegeography.com to learn more. That's benchmark.telegeography.com.
Very useful for SD-WAN projects where you're trying to model MPLS versus internet. It can give you some help. Just be a little careful because sometimes they're a little heavy into the MPLS side and a little optimistic that internet pricing is more expensive than MPLS. So just take that with a grain of salt, but it can help you with planning and budgeting for that.
Go check it out. All right, back to the news. The Public Internet Registry, they manage and operate the .org domain, has penned an open letter regarding possible price increases for .org.
So .org domains is a pretty esoteric corner of the internet, and it's been run by a not-for-profit registry for the last 20 or 30 years, and it mainly exists to just administrate the .org domain. .com, of course, is administered by VeriSign, and all the other domains are actually licensed out and operated independently, and the Internet Society makes money. So 50% of the funds of .org goes to fund and support the Internet Society. But the Public Internet Registry, which runs the .org domain, has now asked the Internet Society to remove price caps. So at this point in time, the PIR can't increase the price of .org domains more than 10% a year. Well, that sounds. But the question here is, if you haven't raised the prices in 3 years at all, why which are you suddenly asked for the caps to be removed?
I mean, my reading is that they want to make quite a significant bump, but this open letter, they're trying to reassure folks that, no, we're not trying to gouge you. We're not looking to do massive price increases. And the structure they want to work under is that if they do announce a price increase, folks who have registered with .org will get a six-month notice and an option to lock in that price for 10 years.
Yeah. Honest, Gov. I'm an honest chap. Oh, I don't cause no trouble. I'll look after you. You know, it's just very odd. I think the weakness here comes in, it's a non-profit. The weakness comes in when not-profit with unregulated pricing models and a captive market is that the organizations have this nasty habit of starting to make up reasons to charge more, like salary increases because industry competitiveness, or people who work for the organization suddenly, because it's not a non, you know, you can charge whatever you like, and there's no cap on what they can charge, they start to lose cost control. And then suddenly staffers start to say, well, we should go to conferences and speak so people know what we're here for. And then, you know, and then they get to go business class because, you know, because. And now I speak from experience, because if you look at a lot of not-for-profit internet exchange organizations who do interconnection of the internet, that's what happened with them. So if you look at the pricing of internet exchange points in Europe, the pricing has actually gone up substantially. And a lot of those people are starting to say, like, you know, the CEO is, you know, we have to retain world-class talent. Yes, so we have to pay.
That's a common justification for.
Yeah. You know where I'm going with this, don't you?
Mm-hmm,
so
I do.
So there's plenty of reasons to doubt that this is going to end well for customers if you happen to have a .org domain name.
Anticipate price increases. That's the message.
you know, I've seen this go wrong so very often. And it's a not-for-profit independent entity. So it's not a government organization for those of you who've got the government, anti-government thing going on. But I've also seen not-for-profit organizations start to take on self-serving parts of this. When you've got control of your own pricing and you can charge whatever you like, they tend to do exactly that.
Yes, there are some here in the United States that I can think of recently who got very much in trouble for spending a little too much on executives and perks and less on the actual mission.
Pharmaceutical companies, for example, same thing. It's a similar sort of model. Once you've got a captive market and they can't go anywhere else.
For sure.
And then they can line their own pockets.
In this blog, they argue that folks could go elsewhere if they want to use a .net or some other domain instead of .org. So there is a little bit of competition, but you can read it and come to your own conclusions, but be wary. When anybody ever says, trust me about the price, then that's a sign.
That's a sure sign.
Have your guard up.
That's like when an IT vendor turns up and says, we'll give you the best price. And you're just looking at them going like, no, you won't. That's not what it is. They're going to give you a price, but it's not going to be the best price.
Best for who?
Exactly. That's exactly the question.
All right, moving on. Symantec CEO Greg Clark has resigned from the security vendor as the company failed to meet Wall Street expectations in its latest financial results. For the fourth quarter, Symantec reported revenues of $1.19 billion, which was down year over year and less than Wall Street's expectation of $1.21 billion.
Yeah, it's been coming for a while, I think. This is not a particular surprise. Symantec has been struggling to find traction and to find new products. It's made a number of acquisitions, and it really hasn't gone anywhere. That said, it's had a nice run-up in price from $17 to $22. So to get him to quit and run away and drop the share price back to where it was at the start of the year is kind of a mixed bag, I think.
Yeah. Apparently, enterprise revenues were, they missed their target as well, $584 million for the quarter, which was about $20 million off of what Wall Street was expecting, although consumer revenue was up.
Yeah, it's an odd one, you know. Apparently it's been investigated by the SEC last year as well for some
reason.
Lots of odd things going on. Maybe there's some internal accounting, but if the numbers aren't working, like we saw Ubiquiti announce their results today, and they're in a hole. They're down 20% because not only did they make their numbers, they're down a million, missed their revenue targets for the next quarter. So there's going to be lots of, shares are down 5% this morning after they announced. So maybe it's just that's very popular for people to beat up people at the moment when they don't make their numbers.
Sure, absolutely. And keep in mind that for the full fiscal year, Symantec had almost $5 billion in revenue. So it's still a lot of money.
They're still a big, big, serious player in the market, but they're not growing against the background of all the other people in there. All their peers are growing and doing well.
Right. So Wall Street wants growth. It always wants growth.
It's always the share price.
All right, well, that's it for the news. Please stay tuned for our Tech Bytes conversation with SnapRoute on their new network OS. That's coming right up. Welcome to Tech Bytes, a quick hit sponsored conversation on new and emerging technologies. Today's sponsor is SnapRoute, maker of CNNOS, or the Cloud Native Network Operating System. SnapRoute is a startup in the network disaggregation space, and we're going to get an introduction to its network OS, find out how SnapRoute differentiates itself, and learn about the operational capabilities it enables. Our guests are Adam Casella, he is co-founder and CTO, and Glenn Sullivan, co-founder and customer success officer. Adam and Glenn, welcome to the podcast. Now, before we get started, you both had pretty compelling backgrounds that you're bringing to SnapRoute. What were you up to before this?
Sure. Well, first I want to say, nice to meet you guys. Glad for you to have us on this call.
Yeah, so Adam and I have a pretty unique background from a vendor perspective. We're not sort of the typical spin out from one of the traditional vendors where, you try to get a product pushed inside of one of the networking vendors and you get frustrated and fed up. So you go start a company and then hopefully it gets spun back in. We actually have a lot of operation experience. We used to run the networks at Apple, the large external data centers, using anything that you would be familiar with as a customer of Apple stuff. So, your iTunes, your iCloud, Siri, Maps, all that sort of thing. When we were there, we got to see a lot of growth. We were there for the launch of iCloud and beyond. So there was a big hockey stick growth. And we had to go from building, bespoke artisanal networks that were reactionary to applications that were launching to, more cookie cutter, fundamental building block type networks where we had to build things before things were being, used. We had to build the network before there was a need for it. So it was a really interesting scaling issue. Previous to that, we were both actually at Cisco in support. So we've got a good, mix of vendor support and understanding from an engineering perspective. on building stuff, but then also how to actually run it. So when you're, you know, waking up in the morning at 3 a.m. trying to figure out what's broken in your network, we've been there. We've lived that.
So you felt the pain because you've worked the help desk, and you've also then lived through the other side of it, waking up at 3 in the morning to do the thing. So that sort of drove you to found SnapRoute and to do things differently.
Yeah, so if you look at some of the things that we were doing at Apple, and particularly it was, okay, rather than writing these or creating these bespoke networks per application, as Glenn was just talking about, is now we need to be able to dynamically adjust the network as needed to make sure it supported the applications that could have been put behind there. It was sort of an early, you know, way of doing microservices before, you know, Kubernetes and some of the more the newer methods have been enabled to go ahead and drive this type of way of doing networking or application development.
So
and
you're sort of referring to the idea of a modular operating system, which was something the vendors all tried over the years, was to build modular. And the idea was that you had a module loading and you could unload it and replace it. And that was a feature that you felt was important?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the end of the day, when you needed to have a certain set of features in a certain location and you needed to then, you know, remove it and replace it with something else, the ability to do that quickly, efficiently, and effectively just wasn't there in anything that we saw that was available in either the traditional OEM world or in the disaggregated market.
And we were getting burned by things that we didn't even have, you know, enabled, right? The first time you're in a data center and you get a .1x bug that crashes a device, you take a step back and you have to explain to your director that you didn't have .1x turned on inside a data center. And they said, well, yeah, but it shows clearly in the logs that you had .1x on, and you have to explain to them, no, the way that this monolithic operating system works, there's intertanglements and everything like that. So you don't have to turn on a feature to be able to be affected by it.
Yeah, the firmware is still running .1x and BFD, even though you've got none of that turned on. It's still there.
Exactly.
It's just a switch or, you know, or whatever the situation might be for a router. So what was the answer? Now, you talk about SnapRoute CNOS being cloud native. Now, cloud native is a pretty wafty term these days. There's an awful lot of broad interpretation. But what does it mean from your point of view?
Yeah, so from our perspective, it's to be able to do scalable, modern, dynamic applications, and whether it be public cloud, private cloud, or, you know, hybrid clouds. And really, from our perspective, that, you know, has containers in microservices running your particular services and applications that you have available to them, and having a declarative API that allows you to programmatically utilize that particular piece of equipment. And the ability to do, you know, immutable updates on a particular component if you wanted to, when moving from one version to a next, different swim lanes for your particular, you know, whether it be, you know, BGP or BFD or adjacency manager from an infrastructure piece for real network-centric pieces of applications, to rather than having to do it where you have to rip and replace an entire monolithic image when you go and update it. So it really gives you a lot of flexibility for how you want to go ahead and manage the services you want to run. So you only need to run what you need. And then on top of that, it allows you to go ahead and address a lot of security vulnerabilities that you couldn't previously much faster and much more reliably than you have in the past. I mean, we can
So explain that out. Why is it that you can now say, you can make that claim? Are you saying because it's in a container, I can just take that piece of the operating system and try and like point a fuzzer at it, but I wouldn't do it on a live box. I'd put it back to Docker on my laptop or something.
Yeah, so that's one method of it. I think, you know, really embracing CI/CD pipelines and the way of doing, you know, continuous integration and continuous deployment or continuous delivery, depending on what acronym you want to take, is really the way to go and do that. So you can take that one piece of that one container and put it into essentially a, you know, test environment and poke and prod all the APIs and interactions that it does with other pieces of the equipment and really narrow down if it's functioning as you want it to and how you expect it before you ever deploy it. And this could be everything from, you know, doing route injection and, you know, security vulnerability testing to just making sure that you're, you know, bringing your BGP states established and stuff like that before you actually deploy it. And you could do that.
So this is less something that I'm going to do, but if I've got a mission critical environment and I absolutely need to know, I might build a continuous software pipeline so that, oh, I've got a new version of this function coming from SnapRoute. I need to run a set of standardized tests against it because these are the problems we've had before. And I push it into a pipeline. It goes off into some Kubernetes types cluster we're running, and it just throws tests at that container. Is that what you're saying? And then when I'm finished, it comes out the other end pristine and ready to rock.
Essentially, yes. And in the way I look at it, it's we have a set of that CI/CD pipeline that we as a vendor go ahead and make sure that we, you know, embrace because we do our all internal testing. But now when you get it as an operator, now you can apply your specific operational tasks that you do in your environment for that particular item. So let's say I update a container. That new container uploaded to the cloud. You download that particular container device, run it through your pipeline, run those tests. Once it passes those and you're satisfied with it, then you can deploy that into production.
So if I want to do, say the only thing I'm using is BGP in the routing protocol stack. So really what I want to be able to do is throw a whole bunch of BGP tests at it. So I would create a test suite of some sort, which would push a million routes into the BGP container into it. And if it passes that and doesn't throw any errors and doesn't crash, you know, maybe I do 1,000 iterations in, out, in, out, pull pushes, half deletes, do a whole bunch of stuff that you think as BGP testing. And at the end of it, you'd have a fairly high level of confidence that somebody got it right.
That's kind of the idea, yeah. So once you're able to take that piece of code and you can put it to the paces in your environment, and to do so in a way that doesn't necessarily have you to rely on, you know, hardware in a lab, you could do some virtual set of testing to ensure it's functioning on those pieces, because those particular mechanisms that you're talking about are all, you know, software based. So you don't have to worry about, you know, how, you know, if you're forwarding, you know, programming things correctly into a particular piece of hardware for that particular set of tests. And then you could take that same exact container that you just tested, the same exact one that you deployed in that virtual environment, pull it out the container and plop it onto, you know, a physical piece of equipment in your infrastructure.
And see, that's important because we've seen real problems with other vendors in the news for security issues who haven't been able to give customers the same code base every single time. And so this is becoming a much bigger issue than it was, you know, a year ago. So
yeah, and it's really trying to, you know, eliminate the inertia, right? It's not like network engineers are out there going, I don't want to ever upgrade because I'm a person who believes to stay on the same code version forever is a good thing, right? It's not what's causing people to, you know, not stay current with, you know, software versions and patches and revisions, right? It's the inertia that's created because, you know, we build this culture of no in networking. You know, something is hard to do. It causes real impact. There's real risk. So I'm not going to do it. I'm only going to do it when I'm absolutely backed against the corner to do it. So if I make it easier for people to upgrade, it only takes a few seconds to deploy a new container as opposed to 20 minutes for an ISSU that's doing who knows what underneath the covers.
Okay.
It makes it a heck of a lot easier.
This probably is a really good point to start talking about exactly how CNNOS actually works, because we haven't sort of mentioned how you actually achieve it. We mentioned this idea of taking modules or containers out and then testing them independently. And that's the idea here, is that I can test my configurations and test them in an automated software pipeline like a developer would. But what makes it so that CNNOS can actually enable that?
Sure. So let me go to a little bit to how our architecture is set up. So for one, we took, you know, basically the smallest primitives that we needed to get an OS up and running and have a very thin Yocto core Linux that boots up when you're running on a particular piece of hardware equipment. And that is the base that we use, is from the, you know, Linux Foundation Yocto project. And then we took Kubernetes. So everyone knows Kubernetes, the orchestrator for containers, and built our OS around the capabilities and the functionality that existed there. So we took applications, network applications in particular, but it could be things that weren't necessarily network specific, and put them into microservice containers that sit around that particular Kubernetes infrastructure. And so what Kubernetes enables you to do, it enables you, one, to abstract away what containers you're having running underneath there using a piece of code called Kubelet. And it gives you a fully fledged API that you can dynamically change and extend as needed to go ahead and programmatically leverage the device. And this includes some of the functionalities like we were just talking about deploying a new pod or container that's sitting on the equipment and doing a rolling update or upgrade of that particular set of functionalities.
Yeah, so I think something that's key here, Kubernetes under the cover, that's great, but what's key is that API, which means I can tie this into operational tools that I've got on premises.
Correct. So the fact that we're, you know, we heavily leverage custom resource definitions that allow us to extend that Kubernetes API for, you know, all sorts of different applications and functions and features. And we've, you know, very closely followed that API version 3 specification, that, you know, basically the Swagger spec to allow you to do that. Now you can go ahead and integrate this with the operational tools that you have running in your system and be able to do those changes in an automated way that you couldn't before using things like Kubernetes operators and stuff like that.
Okay, so that means if I want to use, I don't know, Ansible or some other tooling as part of my operations, I can use APIs to get into the network OS and do what I need to do.
Correct, absolutely. And so just as a sequitur on top of that, while we built everything around the Kubernetes API, we still have a full-fledged CLI that's running on the device that sits on top of that API. So we call it our cloud-native CLI. And essentially what that is a something we call Prism internally. It goes and pulls all the API information from that Kubernetes API and builds it into a Yang hierarchy that you can now, you know, do your traditional networking commands, shell run, configuration interface and stuff like that to go ahead and manage device. But at the end of the day, it's still boiling down to Kube API calls behind the scenes going back to that API.
So if I want to manage a fleet of boxes running CNNOS, I'm probably going to use some kind of tool that's leveraging the API. If I need to go into an individual device and I'm comfortable with CLI, I've got that option as well.
You got it.
Right. And so what you've got is an operating system underneath with Kubernetes running on top. Now, this is, I always think of this as the Windows and apps model. You know, like you might have Microsoft Word and Microsoft Excel, but just because you want to update Microsoft Word doesn't mean you have to update Windows. It's sort of conceptually the same thing, right?
Yeah, at a high level, that's very similar, yes.
Yeah, and that's not something we've normally been able to do in networking equipment. You normally have to pull it out of service to be able to do an update because the whole thing comes as a monolithic image. And you really need to be getting away from that going forward.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to be able to start supporting the dynamic applications that are really becoming prevalent in, you know, I you don't want to use this too heavily, but the cloud-native world that's coming, where you have these distributed applications that are running on there in containers that can, you know, live for a short period of time and then move somewhere else, you need to be able to have your infrastructure to be able to react and adapt to that quickly. And that includes things like being able to, you know, put a change in that they're needed for that particular app from wherever it was located, being able to go ahead and patch a security flaw that might be vulnerable in your particular infrastructure, or updating to add a new feature on there that allows you to now enable that app to do something that it couldn't previously. So you're not sitting there as the basically the piece of the infrastructure that's holding back your business and your application to get it deployed to your customers faster.
Now, you're using an operating system called Yocto, which is an embedded systems operating system. That's very similar to other vendors who tend to use embedded operating systems to minimize the Linux footprint. You're using a version of Linux, which is designed for embedded systems. So there's very little Linux in there that you don't actually want in there.
Correct.
It's the bare minimum, right? So it's not like I took Red Hat and then started carving it out. You took a version of Linux designed for this purpose.
Exactly. And it's very similar to if you ever go back and look how CoreOS originally designed their stuff, to have a very slim version of Linux and all the features and functionality you needed would be in a container sitting on top of that. If you look at it from compute to network and how we designed it, it's very similar in that approach.
Right. So I've got Linux, but not necessarily a version of Linux with all of the Chrome and the tailpipes and the fancy wheels. It's just what I need to get the job done. I guess that leads into a question is does your protocol stack come from? So if I'm going to bet my business on a BGP stack, which is increasingly the way of the future, where does your stack come from?
So today we go ahead and we leverage Metaswitch as our, you know, BGP stack vendor of choice and where we get our protocols from. So that, you know, if anyone who's known Metaswitch, we kind of call it the best unknown name in networking. They've been around for, you know, quite some period of time. They're a UK company and they do, you know, a good job, we believe, with creating their stacks in a hardened way.
It's an open source stack as well, I believe.
So we do get our commercial stack from Metaswitch, and we believe that'll work for most customers, especially ones that are needing a BGP stack that gives them the scale and features that they need in the data center environments. However, there are some use cases coming down the pike where people might want to use like a free-range routing or a bird or maybe an alternative commercial stack. So what it's been really important for us to do is to build the architecture in a way so that we're not locked into any specific stack. We see ourselves much more as a platform for control plane protocols rather than, you know, some fancy wrapping around Metaswitch.
But you're coming out with Metaswitch, who has a very proven stack over a sort of a decade or more. It's not something that you rolled yourself and then we have to have a discussion around is yours the stack that works.
Yeah, I don't want users to, you know, get too worried about the actual control plane protocols when they're evaluating getting into disaggregation, right? I want them to go, okay, that stuff is taken care of by a known entity, checkbox. Now let's look at everything else that we're doing.
So you mentioned disaggregation. What hardware does CNNOS run on?
We run on a handful of different Acton platforms right now, and we're adding some Celestica platforms as we go here. So we support the standard, popular Trident 2 Plus, Tomahawk type devices.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I imagine you would continue to extend that over time as you know customer needs. So the customer fronts up and says, "I want it to run on this." You go, "Sure, we can do that."
That's exactly how we approach the problem. Yep.
And that's exactly how everybody else has done it over the last few years.
Yeah, yeah. There's it's actually a pretty big heavy lift, you know, to support a bunch of different platforms from a bunch of different vendors, even from a lab perspective. So you want to be really strategic about what platforms you support.
Okay, so we've got a sense of how CNNOS works. Can you tell us about what customers are actually doing with this?
Sure. So if you look at, like, you know, one of the things that we've gotten in with customers initially is basically using us as a top of rack device or as an edge device in a network. So basically what it did, you have to get the place where you have that convergence between where you have your DevOps and your NetOps folks who are basically having a device that they kind of have contention over, where you kind of have that tension between what they can do and what they can't do. And this is where the two worlds meet. So we see that as basically the place where we've had the most success with getting integrated with people, because it allows their application folks to get better control of what they need to do to get their application out, but still allows the NetOps folks to, you know, still have control of that piece of equipment if they so chose and be able to leverage it as needed and ensure that they get their, you know, as a business as a whole, that their applications get deployed faster.
Okay, so that space where NetOps and DevOps are colliding, that's where you guys are finding some traction.
Correct, yes.
Okay, so if folks want to find out more about CNNOS or about SnapRoute, where should they go?
Best place is snaproute.com. You could also follow us on Twitter at SnapRoute. We tweet pretty frequently. We link there to any of the events that we're doing, any of the talks that we're giving, any of the papers that we publish.
Fantastic. And we'll have a whole bunch of other links in the show notes. I know you guys did a networking field day. I was at that one. So you got into some good technical demos as well. So I'd recommend folks go check that out. But for now, thank you, Glenn and Adam, for joining us. And thanks to SnapRoute for sponsoring the Packet Pushers. Sponsorship allows us to make this whole enterprise possible. So if you like what you hear, you can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts, along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at Packet Pushers. Find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.